Hello and welcome to the BS History Podcast. My name is BS Dreyer, and whether or not those initials are fitting, I'll let you judge. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about the foundations of the modern state of Mongolia. Now, 100 years ago was a turbulent time in world history, to put it mildly. We tend to remember the First World War and its aftermath as largely playing out between the defeated European powers on one side and the winners, also European powers, with America, of course, as well, on the other side, and their respective colonies and dependent states also being in the mix. But largely, it's focused on a Euro/American, meaning the United States of America, type of perspective. With the Wilsonian moment, so-called, so named after the then President of the United States of America, Woodrow Wilson, it seemed that American-style liberalism and democratization was poised to be the defining ideology or thought or idea that was going to define the early 20th century. As we know, things went a different route, and totalitarianism, both fascist and communist, defined the course of history throughout that era. Now, when we look back at that period in history, it is hard not to have a Eurocentric perspective. Europe is where most of the action took place, and actors within Europe, because Europe as the undisputed center of the world, were the catalysts for much of what happened in the rest of the world, meaning that what happened in Europe affected the whole globe necessarily, just because the center of the globe in many ways, was Europe at the time. And I think we should look at the rest of the world, because fascinating things were happening. Not to say that things in Europe weren't fascinating and aren't important to know about, but they are often retold again and again, and it is fun to get some diversity into your understanding of how the world looked 100 years ago. So therefore, I want to talk about Mongolia. Mongolia, as you might know, is today a representative democracy with a constitution styled along Western ideals. Until 1992, it was, however, a communist state. Today, power swings between the center-right Democratic Party of Mongolia and the Social Democratic People's Party of Mongolia, the latter of which is the descendant of the Communist People's Party, which ruled Mongolia between 1924 and 1992. Why did Mongolia become a communist state in the first place is a fairly valid question. And to find answers, we have to go back to 1911. The Xinghai Revolution in China deposed the last Qing Emperor, or I should say Qing Emperor, I think. My pronunciation, as always, is terrible, and I apologize. This meant that Chinese hegemony in Mongolia had ended, with the last Qing Emperor being deposed during the Qinghai Revolution. At least in what is known as Outer Mongolia, Chinese hegemony had ended. Outer Mongolia, which is what is today the state of Mongolia, should not be confused with the Chinese province of Inner Mongolia. So in 1911, the newly independent Mongolia had to come up with some form of government. And His Holiness the 8th, Jebtsundamba Kutukdu, the spiritual leader of Mongolia's Tibetan Buddhist tradition, was inserted as the Bogd Khan, forming a theocratic state government that held for 10 years until a revolution led by Damdin Sukhbata, Damdin Sukhbata and his fellow revolutionaries captured the capital of Kiri, later renamed Ulaanbaatar, ending the short theocratic rule of the Mongolian people. As a side note, one of Sukhbata's close comrades was Ardin Khatanbata, meaning people's firm hero. Sukhbata means axe hero, and Ulaanbaatar means red hero in Mongolian. So you can say what you like, but the Mongolian people have some cool names, that much is for sure. Sukhbata and Khatanbata were both in the army prior to the 1921 revolution, which took a lot of inspiration from the Russian Revolution a few years prior. Famously, soldiers in the Imperial Russian Navy played a significant part in the success of the Russian Revolution. Similarly, the battle-hardened soldiers in the Bukht Khan's army were instrumental in the foundation of the People's Republic of Mongolia. These soldiers were not, however, fighting other Mongolian forces. In the years after the Qinghai Revolution, the Russian Empire on one side and the Chinese Republican warlords on the other side kept each other in a tense stalemate in regards to Mongolia. Both parties wanted to have Mongolia firmly within their sphere of influence. And with the Russian Revolution in 1919, however, the Imperial Russian Army was no longer the kind of threat that it had been to the Chinese, and so the Chinese warlord Su Xusheng of the Anhui clique saw his chance to reassert Chinese dominance in Mongolia and successfully occupied the country. So for 2 years, roughly, from 1919 until 1921, the Chinese were in power. In early 1921, however, combined Mongolian and White Russian forces, not the drink, but the Imperial Russian loyalists who had fled Russia, led by a man named Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg, together defeated the Chinese. So Mongolian and White Russian, that is imperialist Russian forces, defeated the Chinese led by the Anhui clique. Then some of those same Mongolian soldiers, seeing that Mongolia was not independent but becoming a sort of puppet regime with the Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg pulling the strings, asked the Soviets, who had consolidated their power in Russia, for help. The Soviets obliged, and during the summer of 1921, the Mongolian People's Revolution happened. Of course, the Russian Soviets were very much interested in not having any remnants of the Russian loyalist, imperialists, monarchists anywhere near their borders, who could potentially ruin the revolution that the Soviets had fought so hard for. With fighting between the Mongolian People's Party, supported by the Russian Reds, the Bukht Khaganate, supported by the Russian Whites, and the Chinese Republican Anhui clique, supported by the Japanese, the civil war over the future of Mongolia was hectic, with many different sides and many different interests at play. The communist coalition between the Russian Soviets and the Mongolian People's Party came out on top in the conflict, and Mongolia as a result remained firmly within the Soviet sphere of influence until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990. In those last years of the Bukht Khaganate, from 1919 until 1921, the Bukht Khan was actually still nominally, at least, the highest authority in Mongolia. And even after 1921, Sukhbatar allowed him to stay on the throne until his death in 1924. So he was technically the emperor, or we should say Khan in this case, but it is a rough equivalent in Mongolian language, of Mongolia between 1911 and 1924, which is why 1924 is the official beginning of the Mongolian People's Republic. It's an odd thing for a communist government to allow, it seems, at least to us, but Sukhbatar and many of his compatriots had been schooled in Buddhist teachings as children and were not staunchly Marxist communists, at least not in the early years of communist rule in Mongolia. So that is probably why some sort of deference was there still towards the Bukht Khan, who was, it should not be forgotten, the spiritual leader of the Mongolian people, most of whom were, and most of whom actually still are, Buddhist in the Tibetan tradition. So the years from the collapse of the Chinese Qing dynasty until the establishment of the People's Republic of Mongolia in 1924 was a chaotic time, to put it very mildly, with a push and pull from a lot of different factors and a lot of conflict within Mongolia and at its borders and between the various states and countries who were bordering the country of Mongolia at the time. So you've got Mongolian theocrats, Mongolian workers, Mongolian farmers, Russian communists, Russian imperialists, Chinese warlords, all vying basically for the control of the country. Whether or not the outcome was the best possible, I will not even begin to attempt to judge, but when the Soviet Union collapsed, it did allow for Mongolia to follow in the footsteps of other former Soviet satellite states becoming a representative democracy like it is today. As a side note, the Bukht Khan, who was also, as I mentioned, the 8th Jebtsundamba Gutukdu, had, per Tibetan Buddhist tradition, a reincarnation. The 9th Jebtsundamba Gutukdu was born in 1933, but kept a secret until 1990. When he came to Mongolia and lived until his death in 2012. The process of identifying the 10th Jebtsundamba Gutukdu is underway, incidentally. The Mongolia of today keeps its religious heritage alive, and its two political parties represent both the conservative and socialist ideologies within the country, and things are relatively good and stable for its approximately 3.2 million citizens, here almost 100 years after the most turbulent period in the history of the country. I think stories like the story of Mongolia around the time of the First World War and a little bit later is interesting, particularly to any and all Western listeners who might not have even heard of it or ever considered it, because as with anything that happens on such a global scale as the First World War did, it has ramifications and implications that affect pretty much all people on the face of the earth in some way or form, and Mongolia is a pretty good example of a place where those effects and ramifications were quite substantial and quite important for the Mongolian people. I like to talk about perspective, and this is another one of those stories from history that potentially gives people a little bit of perspective on the history that they are taught in school and otherwise hear about, because history does tend to very much focus on the area of the world where you live and not so much on everywhere else, even though there are fascinating stories from everywhere else. Well, as always, I hope you think today has been a little bit more history than BS. You can find me at BS History Pod on Twitter, and I want to thank you for listening.